access number 32390, Mr. Harold Checkett's reel 2. Now, when you were down in the transmitting room during this battle, obviously you didn't know what was going on or couldn't see what, but were you nervous yourself? Because, I mean, you were well below the waterline.
Oh, yes. I think I've been a nervous person all through my life. You couldn't be unaware of what was going.
Could you hear the noises from the guns firing and things like that? Or was
yes, you could. And you could particularly hear when a shell from the Bismarck struck our ship. I mean, on one of them, it killed nearly all the people on the bridge, apart from the captain. There were others that, came inboard, and we were very lucky in that. I think there were two or three shells, whether they were made by people we never knew in Europe who padded them with something that wasn't the real thing, but there were two or three that came inboard through everything and didn't go off. So we were lucky in escaping from some of the explosions that might have occurred, and they were, I think, I'm not absolutely sure now, but I think they were a bigger caliber than ours, possibly, weren't they?
I think Bismarck's 15 and
yes,
you were 14.
Yes, I thought it was 15 and 14, which makes a big difference, I think.
Now, were you aware, I mean, when were you being hit by the Bismarck shells before you started firing them?
No. I think we both started, but of course it takes a little while in the air for those shells to be lobbing over towards the enemy. I don't remember the exact intervals, there.
So when did you become aware that the Hood had sunk? I don't want to upset you about this, because it's obviously fairly upsetting, but when did you know?
Oh, there were cries aloud, and I think it was probably through the gunnery officer, the words went round so quickly, Hood's gone, Hood's gone up and gone down. I mean, Hood's been hit down. It was all so quick, I remember being, and of course the shock was terrible, and we didn't realise until even afterwards there were only three survivors. And we were ploughing over a similar sea, to where they were.
So what happened next, as you remember that battle then?
Well, from then on, with one or two attempted skirmishes, we really were only shadowing the Bismarck and the Prince Eugen. And I think after a few hours, the Prince Eugen sort of managed to sneak away. And so we ended up shadowing the Bismarck, which was a very important role. But we did lose her. And I don't know whether our losing her was the cause of us having to go back to Iceland and Reykjavik to oil ship, in other words, to fill up again with fuel, because I think by then we'd just about managed to get there but nowhere else, and of course we were handing it over to other people to follow the Bismarck from then on, as soon as we turned round and left. I mean, what we did know was that we had reduced something that we'd done, presumably hit the after part and damaged the screws, possibly, of the Bismarck, but we had reduced the speed quite considerably for probably, the day that we were really shadowing her, or half a day or whatever it was. So, we knew that we'd hit the Bismarck.
Do you know which gun was responsible,
No. And
that is impossible. Isn't
it? No, that's impossible to say, and particularly because, even though the ship was past complete, you couldn't always rely on all the guns to be firing, even when they were supposed to. And of course, we still had on board people from Camel Laird who were constantly doing jobs, particularly anything to do with gunnery, but other jobs as well, though they never got fixed properly, reducing the temperature down below to make it comfortable for, the crew. So, you mustn't, I'm not really being critical because I didn't have enough to do with the Navy, and I was never a naval officer, because I, in fact, when we went into the war, I thought, oh, it'll all be over in 2 years, you see, and I can get back to what I really want to do. Was really an academic life.
Now, this is a cut-down interview, so we're trying to get through quite quickly, yep, because of time constraints. So you carry on the Prince of Wales, and you're on her when she sunk, aren't you? Did you stay in the same role?
Stayed in the same...
Because I presume there was a period of repairs, wasn't there?
Yes, it was quite a while.
Where did you do your repairs?
They were up... I think in the same dockyard where we'd
I'll look that up and I'll put it in the catalogue, so you don't have to think about it. So
I think it was done by Camel Laird.
I think that is Birkenhead, but I mean,
is that what I said, Birkenhead? Yeah. Yes.
But I don't know. I'll put it in the catalogue.
Obviously, they'd be the people to do it.
Did you stay aboard ship while she was repairing?
For quite a lot of the time, yes, but we did get, I think, a week's leave out of that, and I was very pleased because I was still limping badly from my, so I couldn't do much at home apart from put more poultices and bandages on and things like that, but came all the way down by train, and went back up. But there were, by the way, very interesting developments for the Prince, which in between the that Hood job, when we lost the Hood and eventually contributed to sinking the Bismarck, and the final sinking in off Malaya, but I would like to mention that, of course.
Whatever you want to do, we'll record,
yes,
obviously.
You see, one of the first jobs we did was to take the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, across to Placentia Bay in Newfoundland to meet President Roosevelt. And of course, some of us were particularly privileged in seeing them at very close quarters. I mean, I used to be strolling around, and the Prime Minister would be strolling around. And, I always wondered, I always saluted the naval salute to get by, but I didn't think that he, at the time, that he looked particularly well. And I thought, he's not going to last, but he lasted about another 40 years. After that, there were other things, and of course, the great fun coming back was when our own convoys of ships realised that Churchill was aboard, and we had to go manoeuvres through these huge convoy with the Prince of. With Churchill on, and the great cheers coming up all the time. We got close enough to hear them on other ships and things like that. But another thing we did, we helped to take some pretty vital supplies to Malta. So we were on a quite important Malta convoy.
As
distant escort. But I mean, we got all these ships with us. I think there was one of them sunk, and of course.
Now, what month was that? Do you remember? We could look it up again. It's not difficult to track.
Yes, it was called. It was called Halberd, the name of the convoy and the relief of Malta. I mean, it was pretty vital, I gather.
Now, what do you remember of that? Were you still in your transmitting station, were you?
Oh, yes. All my action stations was always down there. And so I remember that I gather we shot one of the tails off one of the Ark Royals planes. Mm-hmm. But of course, I mean, we never knew who shot any enemy planes down, because you know I wouldn't have known. So that was quite an exciting trip into the Mediterranean. And but after that, I suppose the next important thing was the preparation for going to the Far East.
Now, what preparations were those?
Well, we of course returned back to Scapa, and we spent such a long time provisioning ships and taking so much stuff on board, you know, tropical kit and this and that, and you know, and that there was almost a little sort of mutiny on board. People sort of talked and said, surely we can't keep filling these lighters or emptying these lighters, you know, how long are we going to go on with this sort of thing? Quite a lot of moaning went on, and they said, why is it always the Prince of Wales that gets picked for these jobs? You know, there were quite a... And strangely enough, when we got back to, you know, I remember when we got back to Reykjavik, some of our own sailors got in conflict with other ones who accused the Prince of Wales of being the Jonas ship. They said, you know, it brings bad luck where it goes. So, I mean, that wasn't a nice reputation, especially after we'd been called the Daily Mirror battleship by quite a lot of people.
Why were we called that?
Well, because it was publicised quite a lot by the Daily Mirror. And, of course, it looks after the event as if Churchill had, in fact, got a very soft spot for the Prince of Wales, you know, as the first of... it wasn't the first, but it was, you know, an important thing that happened when he was a Prime Minister, and he favoured it, and he'd used it to do different things. And probably he also chose it as one of the ships to go in connection with the Admiralty to the Far East.
And what about the voyage out to the Far East then?
Well, that was quick, if I might say so. That we went, I remember sailing and going at good speed with destroyer escorts down to Africa, and Freetown was the first place we called. That was our first sort of tropical, really tropical little town to visit. I remember that, and I remember the people coming out in boats to try and catch pennies or whatever it was at the time. And then, of course, we sailed again from Freetown because we were in a hurry to get to the Far East, and the next thing was crossing the line. I remember the first time I crossed the line, and then on down towards Cape Town, where we stopped. And we were very royally treated by the people of Cape Town, but in the end we were hurried away because of developments in the Far East. People must have known, intelligence must have got through that things were happening there that didn't bode very well, that something might be urgent. So we went on round up through to, I think we called in at Seychelles, and then on up to Colombo, and round to Trincomalee, or round onto that side of Ceylon as it was then, which I loved as a place. We picked up the Repulse there, and the Repulse then went with us to down the you know, the straits, the Malaccan Straits, and I think it was Straits of Johor, was it, and Straits of Singapore, and ended up in Singapore with the two battleships, and we immediately got treated as if it was almost peacetime. You know, people were had already gone into tropical kit anyway, and then there were awnings put up on the ship, and it was, you know, people were invited on board from Singapore, just as if, I'm sure, you know, a lot of them from Singapore probably thought it was like a peacetime visit. And that was, I think we got there about the 2nd of December. We'd been travelling in the last week of November, and I remember it very well because there was a fellow on my mess deck. Well, there were most people on the mess deck, you know, had given up on the Russians. And but I said that when it came to the crunch, people like the Russians would not be completely overrun. You know, they'd given up hope that the Russians would be of much use to us. And I said, no, it doesn't matter what government you've got, if it's left to the people in the end to defend it, they will. And so I remember that just before we got into Singapore, so it must have been towards the end of November, I suppose. And then, of course, did we have a week? No, I don't suppose. Well, we might have had a week. And we went ashore in Singapore and saw, you know, Raffles Hotel and one thing and another, that, and bought materials. I bought a lovely lot of materials for my mother and sister, you know, the things they'd never seen before, and of course they never did see them. You know, we all quite enjoyed it. It was rather warm, but, you know, we tolerated the beer that was provided, tiger beer, I think it was. And so, you know, nice little trips ashore, and because you didn't need many people to maintain the ship when you were in harbour or were anchored like we were in one of the straits, of course you... you had most ships of the ship's company could be free to go ashore at any given time. You could have up to three quarters or even more of the you know, the crew ashore. And then, of course, a few days later, things really became obvious to the authorities, and that. Everything was deteriorating in terms of international relations. The Japanese were, and I think it was the 7th that was Pearl Harbor, and almost as soon as that was announced, and in fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that at the very time of Pearl Harbor, some Japanese had actually landed in the north of Malaya. But I mean, that's by the way. They decided, and the admiral we'd got on board was Tom Thumb. And he was now on board the prince, the admiral, who was in charge of this.
Phillips.
Admiral Tom Thumb Phillips. I was trying to Tom Thumb Phillips because he was rather small. Thank you for the tip, because you know my memory isn't that brilliant. They took us up to. See, my memory for the geographical names isn't. We went out of Singapore. We sailed out, and we started going north. I think the hope was that we would be able to do all sorts of things with when we met enemy warships. But it hadn't been, I think it hadn't been realized how, I'm sure until even after the war, a lot of it, how the Japanese, who'd come into the Mediterranean and kindly had a good look at Taranto when it was being dealt blows by the Navy in the Med, when I wasn't there, you know, they'd learned a great deal about torpedoes and the sort of planes that you needed to, I mean, they'd already got a lot of these things going, I'm sure, and very powerful they were. You know, their torpedoes were very big, and they never failed to go off. Germans, or, you know, I don't know about our own because I wasn't on the other end, but they always seemed to succeed in what they, you know, if they hit, they really hit. Anyway, we went up and we then eventually, after about a day or so out at sea, when we got about as far north as we were intending to go, and we hadn't seen any of these Japanese vessels coming to invade to land and invade Malaya, we'd not bumped into any of them. They'd all cleared off, they'd landed and gone, and so we pressed on and then did a sort of indecisive tours around, it seemed to me anyway, and then of course we were freed to do our duties some of the time, even from the TS's crew, and of course as a seaman I would be fell in you know, to help scrub the upper deck, that was the after part of the ship, and we were up there, and one of the chaps working with me, with one of these scrubbers, you know, they were like a scrubbing brush, but with a long handle, and he said, isn't that a tiny little plane up there? Can you see it? And he called the other two or three of us doing this scrubbing job up there. And we said, yes, that is a plane. My word, it is high up, isn't it? And of course, one of us, you know, went and alerted the officer of the watch. And in no time at all, the whole of the ship's company was closed to action stations. And I mean, it was in a great.
You went down to yours.
Yes, that's right. Everybody had to go rushing to their action stations because the bell rang so furiously after this had been seen that you realised, you know, that it was action stations. although it was only a spotter plane, it meant a lot, or could mean a lot, and it was realised straight away by the officer of the watch. So. In no time at all, we were all at our action stations. And it wasn't long. I don't remember. I might have told you some time ago, but it, you know, when it all started, when the first Japanese squadrons appeared. And at first, they were thought to have been. Someone said, so the gunnery officer, I mean, whatever the gunnery officer said, I overheard if it was sort of public or to someone else in the DS room, that they were planes that they bought from the Americans, Maryland bombers and things like that, that they were using against us. But of course, they turned out to be, you know, the good old Mitsubishi and so on in the end. And, of course, when they did come in their squadrons and their flights of 7 or 9 or whatever they were, they pressed on absolutely regardless. They dropped their torpedoes or bombs, just occasionally it would be a bomb, at the levels at which they intended to drop them. Even sometimes, you know, I gather from people on the upper deck that they could actually see the pilots.
Was your forward transmitting station dealing with any anti-aircraft fire, or was it just the main armament?
It was the main armament primarily, but of course it did deal with the 525s. We'd got 8 on each side of 525, so it was a big, you know, battery of anti-aircraft guns. They equally relied on directions and things from
you.
From us.
Well, not you. From the station.
They'd actually got a hit or two.
Now, what were the hit? I mean, what happened? So what's the sequence of events for you down below?
Well, the sequence of events for me, I remember I think it was when they hit with 1 or 2 torpedoes one of our screws. I think they hit the screw itself or the sort of protection it would have had. And that, of course, gave us a list, I remember that, a very sudden list over towards the side which had been hit. And it was quite, you know, you were walking, you were on a slope. And, no. And of course, they'd hit in more than one place. And the trouble was that where they happened, they were lucky in one sense because, of course, they were putting out of action the power for the 525s at the same time. Not only had they caused a list, which meant that you couldn't even do anything with the 14-inch stuff, because there were suggestions that we ought to open fire with the 14-inch. I never understood that myself, because I didn't know what you could really do with 14-inch guns against the, you know, a squadron of planes. But it developed, you know, then bit by bit, and then the attention was back onto the repulse, which was getting really hammered, and I think a bomb amidships killed people there, and they were in a much worse position very quickly as regards being immobilized than we were. And even when we were immobilized, we stayed afloat longer. Which of course was a great help in getting more people away eventually.